Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 137. It's Monday, November 8th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, COVID-19 doesn't seem to want to go away. Let's start with the local COVID-19 update for Lucas County. The average number of daily cases over the last week rose to 124 from 121 the previous week, and Ohio does seem to be in the thick of it. All 88 Ohio counties are categorized as high transmission. We had one of our 88 counties that dropped to substantial transmission the previous week, but we're back up to where we've been for the last couple months, is that all 88 counties are meet the CDC's definition of high transmission. It ain't over yet. Well, we did have our testing positivity rate, that's the number of people who seek testing and get testing, that test positive dropped slightly to 9.8% from 10.1%. the previous week. So that's good as far as the trend. Of course, that's still way above. That's a pretty high testing positivity rate. Should try to get down to 5% or less. Ohio, on the other hand, which has been declining slowly and has been lower than Lucas County, also had a 9.8% testing positivity rate. And that's a reversal of fortune. We saw the levels of testing pretty much level off in Lucas County, but the volume is actually going up in the state. Seems to look like the rural areas are heating back up as far as the pandemic is going. Ohio is entering the flu season. The U.S. Held steady at around a 5% testing positivity rate, much better than Ohio and Lucas County. Nursing homes in Lucas County ticked back up to 42 active cases in the most recent week, up from 26 the previous week. It was 18 residents and 24 staff with active COVID-19 cases, and we had another death in long-term care facilities. Okay, in schools, we did see that the number of identified cases decreased in Lucas County among Lucas County students. We had 26 staff and 141 students were identified with COVID-19 in the most recent week, which is down slightly from 39 staff and 168 students the week before. So that's a good trend, and that's a trend that's been continuing. In Ohio, though, it's been holding steady or actually going up. The number of staff went up a little bit to 639 staff, and the students' number held relatively steady at 3,378. Okay, University of Toledo, similar story. They had 40 active cases identified. Seven of those were through the surveillance testing, which they randomly test people where they had seven positives for a 0.9% positivity rate, which is a little higher than they've had. Seems that they're settling in, kind of leveling off at this amount of cases. They are approaching their vaccine mandate. The students need to prove by November 15th that they are vaccinated or be subjected to weekly testing. Okay, hospitalizations in Lucas County have leveled off in the last couple weeks, and they do seem to be edging down in Ohio. Deaths are falling nationally. Still, there are over 1,100 deaths per day. And Lucas County had 49 deaths reported in the last 2 weeks. This is greater than the amount of deaths we had in the middle of last winter, at the worst of the pandemic last winter. This pandemic is not over. Lucas County is still suffering and people are dying. The national death rate at over 1,100, that's still stubbornly high. I'd like to see that under a couple hundred, which we just barely edged under at the low point in the summer before things started jacking up. And as cases are leveling off or ticking up nationally, flu season is here, COVID-19 season is here, very well may not see much of a bigger drop in the deaths as we go into wintertime. Okay, vaccinations. Looking at fully vaccinated, we had the smallest rise in new fully vaccinated people in the U.S. than I think we've had since robust vaccination availability has been here. It only went up 0.4% from 58% of the total population to 58.4%. And it's even worse in Ohio. Went up 0.1% in Ohio and 0.1% in Lucas County over the last week. That's, again, the smallest ever. And we've gone from slowing down the number of new people getting fully vaccinated to basically almost stopped. It looks like we're going into the winter with the vaccination rate we got, not the vaccination rate we want. And there are plenty of unvaccinated people out there as kindling for the COVID-19 fire. Looks like we're still going to be dealing with this for many months here. In fact, an interesting shift in the vaccination is since they've been offering boosters and since rates have been going down somewhat nationally and even locally in state, although they've ticked back up, people really seem to, we're not seeing new people being driven to getting vaccinated. And as far as public health, there's been a very much of a switch to giving booster shots. So almost 90% of all the vaccines that have been given in the last couple of weeks have actually been booster shots rather than people getting fully vaccinated or on their way to fully vaccinated. Okay, well, let's do a few COVID-19 stories, and then we'll get on to some non-COVID-19 news. But first up from the Washington Post, a vaccine story. White House vaccine rule requires companies and workers to comply by January 4th. Companies with more than 100 employees will be mandated to require coronavirus vaccines for their workers or do regular testing by January 4th under the terms of a new federal rule released last Thursday by the Biden administration. The hotly anticipated rule, which is being implemented on an emergency basis by the Department of Labor, is one of the White House's most strenuous attempts to increase vaccination rates across the country. The new policy would require weekly testing and mandatory face masking for workers who choose not to get vaccinated. It also specifies that employers must provide paid time off for workers to get vaccinated or recover from any side effects, but companies are able to require unvaccinated employees to foot the bill for tests. Low-wage, hourly, and frontline workers have been particularly hard hit by the pandemic, said Representative Robert Scott of Virginia, the chairman of the House Committee on Education and Labor, who has pushed for the Department of Labor to act more aggressively on workplace safety throughout the pandemic. Workplace vaccination policies will save lives, protect our economic recovery, and help us finally get things back to normal. So far, 222 million Americans have received at least one dose of the vaccine, but the numbers vary widely in different parts of the country. During a surge of the virus's Delta variant in the late summer, White House officials escalated efforts to vaccinate more Americans, leading to a new emergency rule. Coronavirus vaccines have proved successful at preventing infection and have in many cases minimized the symptoms of those who do become sick, offering what public health experts say is the best chance to lead the country out of the pandemic. But many Republicans have asserted that having the federal government become involved in the vaccine rules amounts to an unfair government edict. A number of GOP governors and attorneys general have promised to challenge the policy in court. Labor and White House officials spent weeks hammering out the text, keeping an eye on the high likelihood of legal challenges it would face and the complexity of issues raised by a rule that will apply to hundreds of thousands of businesses. The White House estimates the policy will apply to 84 million workers across the country. More than 70 business groups, individuals, and other interested parties met with officials in the final days before the rules were released to ask questions and express concerns about things like how the requirement would affect staffing, with labor shortages if people refuse to comply and quit their jobs. A number of industries are already struggling to find employees, particularly in sectors like construction and trucking. The policy is likely to increase compliance costs and cause regulatory burdens that will exacerbate several headwinds facing the construction industry, Ben Brubeck, Vice President of the Associated Builders and Contractors, said in a statement. The rule tracks very closely to the plan announced by the White House in September, though it could be modified going forward. For example, written in the text of the 490-page rule is a hint that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, may explore expanding the rule in the future to cover all businesses, not just those with more than 100 employees. OSHA is confident that employers with 100 or more employees have the administrative capacity to implement the standards requirements promptly, but is less confident that smaller employers can do so without undue disruption, it said, saying it would seek public comment on the matter. Because of the testing option, the new White House ruling does not constitute a strict vaccine mandate. In fact, it is softer than many of the policies instituted by many private companies, as well as state governments that have required vaccinations for employees. Still, the new federal ruling is expected to give companies that had hoped to institute more stringent mandates, but backed off for fear of employee opposition, more political cover to do so. Companies that don't comply could face the potential of $13,000 fines per violation or $136,000 per willful violation, potentially adding hundreds of thousands of dollars or more in fines for companies that are found to be well outside of the rules. The release of the rule was paired with the release of a vaccine mandate for workers at facilities that participate in Medicaid or Medicare. Those employees will be required to be fully vaccinated by January 4th, adding an additional 17 million workers to the requirement at 76,000 medical facilities. Medical or religious exemptions will apply in these cases. All told, the federal government's various vaccine requirements will apply to more than two-thirds of the workforce, officials said. The Department of Labor estimates the rule will prevent more than 250,000 hospitalizations from workplace COVID-19 exposure and save thousands of lives. Even before the rule's implementation, more than a third of U.S. workers now say their employer is requiring them to get vaccinated. COVID-19 has had a devastating impact on workers, and we continue to see dangerous levels of cases, said Labor Secretary Marty Walsh. Opposition has been marshaling in advance of the OSHA's rules release at the political level. Republican attorneys general in at least 24 states have vowed to fight the rule in court, and one, Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, has already filed a lawsuit against the federal government over it. Some states, including Missouri, are pledging to explore legislation that could exempt their state from the requirement. But officials from OSHA and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services told reporters that the new rules preempt any state or local laws that seek to ban or limit employer authority for vaccination, masks, and testing, like one that Republicans in Texas passed recently. They said they plan to take action if states that have their own occupational health plans, which are required to be at least as stringent as the federal rules, do not comply with the federal plan. The mandates appear to enjoy support by many Americans. A September Gallup poll found that 58% of Americans said they support the coming OSHA requirement, and 63% said they supported the mandate at Medicaid and Medicare facilities. Labor unions like the American Federation of Teachers and the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union cheered the new rules, citing the health threats workers have faced throughout the pandemic. The GOP efforts to continue to contest the rule come in addition to legal battles in states including Minnesota, New York, Texas, Michigan, Kentucky, Ohio, and others over other coronavirus vaccine mandates. More than 10 Republican-controlled states have also filed a lawsuit against the federal government for its vaccine requirements for federal contractors. But those mandates have mostly withstood legal challenges, as have private mandates imposed by big companies and hospital systems. Mandates do appear to have led to an increase in vaccination. United Airlines, which had one of the strictest mandates for a major air carrier, said its employee vaccination rate increased to more than 99%. Delta, which used financial penalties and testing requirements, saw the employee vaccination rate go to 90% from 75%. Tyson Foods said recently that at least 96% of its employees were vaccinated in advance of its November 1st deadline, up from under 50% before it announced the mandate in August. Many hospitals in New York saw vaccination rates increase to more than 95% by the deadline of the state's mandate for healthcare workers, up from 70% to 80% range before the rule was announced. In California, major hospitals saw vaccination rates increase to about 90% after a similar, albeit slightly less stringent, mandate. The White House has said these types of vaccination mandates have been increasing rates by more than 20 percentage points among their target populations, and has cited other studies showing that increased vaccination would help smooth the way for the economic recovery. In New York, which instituted a mandate for municipal workers, about 91% of the city's workforce had at least one shot by the deadline earlier this week, which officials hailed as a significant success. Those numbers rose steadily as the deadline approached, increasing 5 percentage points in the final days. About 9,000 workers, less than 2.5% of the city's 378,000-person workforce, were placed on unpaid leave because they didn't get vaccinated, despite protests and threats from anti-vaccine contingents in the police, fire, and sanitation departments that the mandate would lead to massive labor shortages. Another 12,000 workers have pending medical or religious exemptions, officials said. There, and in other cities like Los Angeles, firefighter and police unions have sought to challenge the mandates in court. In Chicago last Monday, a judge blocked the city's December 31st deadline for enforcing a vaccination mandate for the police department in a lawsuit brought by the police union, saying the two sides need more time to resolve the dispute. The judge left intact the city's current rules, which require municipal workers to report their vaccination status and pay for twice-weekly testing if they are not vaccinated. Another judge in the city recently dismissed a motion to halt the city's requirement. Overall, 32 of the 34 city departments in Chicago say that at least 92% of their employees are in compliance with the city's rule. But those numbers have lagged among police and fire departments, with only 72% of police and 87% of the fire department in compliance, according to WBEZ. Some other labor unions, advocates, and workers have hailed the effort. The COVID-19 pandemic was a whole other story. It showed how much we need strong OSHA standards in Barden, a dietary aid cook and union member at Trinity Healthcare in Connecticut, said during a recent interview conference organized by the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health about the coming rule. Barden spoke about the toll the pandemic took on workers, saying that at one point, half of the staff members were out sick or in quarantine. "We welcome OSHA's more aggressive approach," Barden said. And I'd just like to note, I've actually seen that lax OSHA enforcement has been one of the most underreported stories during this pandemic. Certainly during the Trump administration, OSHA did virtually nothing, barely even responding to huge numbers of complaints from workers. And if they respond, doing like voluntary with little follow-up. So in essence, there was no enforcement, besides the fact of not really having strict rules at all. But certainly COVID-19 as a workplace health issue is huge. I mean, it's interesting because police and fire department employees are way more likely to die from COVID-19 than they are to die on the job from other workplace hazards. So we know that it's definitely in the range of a serious health problem, and it's definitely something that can be transmitted in the workplace, and particularly service jobs that are doing a lot of interface with the public. There's an additional responsibility as public service workers. Okay, well, as this pandemic goes on, we get more and more evidence about what works and what doesn't. This from Science Daily: new study explicitly links protection of water access with lower COVID-19 infection and death rates. A new analysis finds U.S. states that prevented utilities from turning off water services to households that were behind on their payments during the COVID-19 pandemic experienced significantly lower rates of infection and death from the pandemic while the moratoria were in effect. The study, published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, underscores the importance of water equity and the need for government actions to create more uniform protections from water shutoff across all states. A related analysis of the data suggests that a nationwide moratorium on water shutoff might have prevented as many as 500,000 people from COVID-19 infections and nearly 9,000 deaths. "Access to water is absolutely critical during the pandemic," said co-investigator Mildred Warner, Departments of City and Regional Planning and Global Development, Cornell University. "This study shows the importance of a national standard for access to water, especially for low-income households. The COVID-19 pandemic has revealed so many structural inequities in our society, and access to drinking water is one that demands our attention." The investigators observed that while Congress acted to prevent housing evictions during the pandemic, national leadership is absent in protecting equitable access to water. They noted that in the U.S., water bills have increased faster than inflation. Research suggests that 35.6% of U.S. households may not be able to afford their water bills over the next 5 years. They propose payment plans and arrearage management programs for low-income households. Better data collection and reporting are necessary to help inform policies and solutions. Water is life, people. Okay, last on the coronavirus front, a really interesting story, this from the New York Times. Widespread coronavirus infection found in Iowa deer, new study says. A new study of hundreds of white-tailed deer infected with the coronavirus in Iowa has found that the animals probably are contracting the virus from humans and then rapidly spreading it among one another, according to researchers. Up to 80% of deer sampled from April 2020 through January 2021 in the state were infected, the study indicated. Scientists said the findings pose worrisome implications for the spread of coronavirus. Although they were not able to identify how the deer might have contracted the virus from humans, there is no evidence that deer have passed the virus back to humans. Researchers and outside experts characterized the study's findings as a troubling development in the course of the pandemic. Widespread infection among North America's most ubiquitous game species could make eradicating the pathogen even more difficult, especially if they become a reservoir for mutations that eventually spill back over to humans. The study has not been published in a peer-reviewed science journal yet, but its authors at Penn State University and wildlife officials in Iowa found the results so disturbing that they are alerting deer hunters and others who handle deer to take precautions to avoid transmission. Earlier this year, a multi-state survey of white-tailed deer by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service turned up antibodies for the virus among less than half the deer in four states, but that study confirmed exposure, not infection. Antibodies could mean the deer fought off infection. This new analysis, conducted by examining the lymph nodes of samples from roadkill and from those felled by hunters, showed active infections. The veterinary microbiologists who led the Penn State study, Sharush Kuchipudi and Vivek Kapoor, said they were not prepared to find such widespread infection. It was effectively showing up in all parts of the state. We were dumbfounded. Evidence of transmission from people, the scientist said, was found in the genomic sequencing of the samples collected over months that reflected the various lineages circulating among humans. There is no reason to believe the same thing isn't happening in other states where deer are present, Dr. Kapoor said. Previous studies have hinted at such a possibility because a number of other animals are susceptible to infection with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19 in humans. They include ferrets and primates that have been intentionally infected in lab experiments, zoo animals that caught the virus from their handlers, and captive mink that were sickened after being exposed to the pathogen by farm workers. In the case of mink, the coronavirus has already demonstrated an ability to sicken animals infected by humans, and last year Denmark slaughtered its entire population of 17 million farmed mink after scientists discovered they could pass the virus back to people. The virus, they found, had also picked up mutations along the way, but officials said none were especially worrisome. If the virus were to become endemic in wild animals like deer, it could evolve over time to become more virulent and then infect people with a new strain capable of evading the current crop of vaccines. The findings were verified by federal scientists at the National Veterinary Services Laboratories, according to a spokesperson. Scientists unaffiliated with the study who reviewed the findings said they were stunned, but not entirely surprised. If deer can transmit the virus to humans, it's a game changer, said Tony Goldberg, a veterinarian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who studies the evolution of infectious diseases as they jump from animals, between animals and people. To have a wildlife species become a reservoir after transmission from humans is very rare and unlucky, as if we needed more bad luck. The Penn State researchers have been working with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, which already conducts surveillance on chronic wasting disease, a fatal neurological illness among white-tailed deer. The first positive test results showed up in September 2020 in two deer at different ends of the state. Between late November and early January, as the pandemic was surging in humans across Iowa, 80% of deer specimens tested positive for the virus. By then, the researchers had tested only 300 of the 5,000 lymph nodes available to them, but the evidence was overwhelming. Such a high rate of infection, Dr. Kuchipudi said, was effectively 50 times greater than its prevalence among Iowa's human residents during the peak of the pandemic. What they found as they probed deeper was even more astounding. Using tests to decode the genomic makeup of each viral sample, they found similar patterns between the emergence of mutations and variants in the state's deer population and those infecting people. Researchers said That offered stronger proof of human-to-deer transmission, as well as evidence that deer were then spreading the virus to one another at a rapid clip. Mapping the location of each sample also suggested the infections were occurring simultaneously across the state as hunting season ramped up. The study's authors say it is unclear whether the deer were sickened by the infection. How the virus passes from people to deer, however, is not entirely clear. Rachel Rudin, Iowa State wildlife veterinarian and author of the study, said there are plenty of opportunities for transmission, given that 445,000 deer roam the state. The virus can spread when people feed deer in their backyard, through sewage discharges, or maybe when an animal licks a splotch of chewing tobacco left behind by an infected hunter. Perhaps it doesn't take much of a loading dose to get deer infected, she said. But either way, all this is a striking example that we're all in this pandemic together. The study raises a multitude of questions that scientists will be keen to examine, including whether other wild animals can also carry the virus, particularly rodents like mice that live in even closer proximity to people. The more species capable of carrying the virus, the greater the chance it can evolve in ways that threaten human health. Such a scenario is not at all far-fetched. Even if the exact origins of SARS-CoV-2 remain a subject of debate, many scientists are inclined to believe the virus was a product of natural transmission from animals, most likely bats. There's no shortage of unpleasant pathogens that toggle between humans and animals, among them yellow fever, West Nile virus, and strains of seasonal influenza that can affect birds and pigs. Despite their concerns that the country's 38 million white-tailed deer could become a lasting reservoir for the coronavirus, experts say such a scenario does not mean all hope is lost in the battle to conquer the pandemic. A dangerous mutation that one day finds its way from deer to people could be tackled with a booster shot, not unlike how vaccines for the seasonal flu are developed each year. A coronavirus vaccine for deer is also a possibility. Scientists have already created them for zoo animals. But the practicality of inoculating millions of free-roaming ungulates would be daunting, to say the least. There's your bonus word for the day, ungulates. That is animals with hooves. There's a lot of those, considering that that cattle and pigs are included in that. In the meantime, several states have advised deer hunters to take precautions when dealing with white-tailed deer. Wear rubber gloves and perhaps a mask when field dressing and processing. Sanitize hands and instruments after dressing. And bag carcass remains before disposing in trash. Health officials say eating cooked venison carries little risk as long as it reaches an internal temperature of 165 degrees Fahrenheit. Barbara Hahn, a disease ecologist at the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, who has been studying the spillover capacity of SARS-CoV-2 in various mammals, said the findings reinforce the need for a more robust system of surveillance that can quickly detect the transmission of pathogens from animals to people. The pandemic has already prompted better coordination among laboratories across the United States, but she said she hoped the latest findings might turbocharge efforts to create a national, federally funded surveillance network for so-called zoonotic diseases. Despite a global death toll that has surpassed 5 million, Dr. Hahn and other experts say COVID-19 could have been far deadlier, a possibility underscored by viruses like Ebola. We can't keep playing whack-a-mole with these zoonotic diseases because it's just too costly, both financially and from a human losses standpoint, she said. We have got to do better. Okay, well, that may be bad news for us, but it's good news for Corey the Coronavirus.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's move on to a plethora of non-COVID news. Some updated issues with lead poisoning, this from the Washington Post. CDC changes its definition of lead poisoning in young children. For young children, any amount of lead exposure is bad. The element can damage children's brains, stunt growth, and cause developmental problems. Now, a new definition of lead poisoning will increase the number of U.S. children found to have dangerously high levels of lead in their blood. In 2020, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation and UNICEF found that a third of the world's children have lead poisoning and estimated that 1.23 million children in the United States have high blood lead levels. The number will now rise thanks to a change in the way the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention defines lead poisoning. The agency used to define lead poisoning in children as 5 micrograms per deciliter of a child's blood. Now it has lowered the number to 3.5 micrograms per deciliter. The move is in response to recommendations by a committee of experts in child health, toxicology, and related areas who are charged with advising the Health and Human Services Department on lead exposure and prevention. The number of children who meet the criteria is expected to double with the new rule, the Associated Press reports. Lead poisoning is preventable and can be kept at bay by reducing exposure to lead-based paints, contaminated soil, and certain foods, medicines, and cosmetic products, usually imported from other countries. Low-income children and children of color, many of whom live in housing built before national lead-based paint laws were revised in 1978, are disproportionately affected nationwide. Young children are especially at risk because of their rapid growth and development. They're also curious and tend to put things in their mouth as they explore the world around them. Their bodies can absorb up to 5 times as much ingested lead as adults. No level of lead is safe, and yet half of our nation's children are at risk of lead exposure, often in their own home, Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra said in a news release. Okay, next up, news from the Guttmacher Institute. Looks like we're going backwards on sex ed. Only half of U.S. adolescents get sex ed that meets minimum federal standards, new study shows. Adolescents in the United States are not getting the sex education they need, as only about half of young people aged 15 to 19 nationwide are receiving sex education that meets minimum federal standards, according to a new Guttmacher Institute study published in the Journal of Adolescent Health. Researchers used nationally representative data from the National Survey of Family Growth and found that more adolescents are learning about how to say no to sex than about how to use contraceptives, even though absence-only programs have been found not to be effective. They also found young people today are less likely to receive information about birth control during formal sex education than they were 25 years ago. The study, conducted in collaboration with Rutgers University, also finds widespread gender and racial disparities in adolescents' access to comprehensive sex education. In addition, U.S. religious institutions are playing a central role in sex education, but most do not provide comprehensive information. Some of the key study findings, from 2015 to 2019, only about half of adolescents nationwide received sex education that met minimum federal standards. Many adolescents do not receive any instruction on essential topics such as contraception and HIV or sexually transmitted infection prevention. And less than half, 43% of females and 47% of males, received federally recommended instruction before they had sex for the first time. More adolescents receive instruction about how to say no to sex, that is 81% of females and 79% of males, than instructions about birth control, with only 64% of females and 63% of males. By comparison, in 1995, 87% of female adolescents and 81% of male adolescents received education about birth control methods. Yikes, about double the number of people not receiving such instruction. Fewer than half of blacks, 33%, and Hispanics, 41%, males received education on Fewer than half of black and Hispanic males received education on all the following topics before they first had sex: saying no to sex, birth control, and HIV and sexually transmitted infection prevention. These proportions compare with 58% of white males who received such instruction. Black females, 30%, were less likely than their white peers, 45%, to learn about where to get birth control before they first have sex. Almost no adolescents who received instruction about birth control received this information in a religious setting. Some 92% of adolescent females and 98% of males who received instruction about birth control methods received this information in school. Okay, we always like reporting on the single largest preventable cause of death in the U.S., that is tobacco use, this from NPR. Cigarette sales went up last year for the first time in 20 years. For the first time in two decades, cigarette sales increased last year during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tobacco companies also beefed up spending to promote their products. The Federal Trade Commission, in its annual cigarette report, said that manufacturers sold 203.7 billion cigarettes in 2020, up from the 203 billion in 2019, an increase of 0.4%. The company's report said increased advertising and promotion to 7.8 billion in 2020 from 7.6 billion the previous year, concentrating the bulk of their spending in price discounts paid to cigarette retailers in order to reduce the price of cigarettes to customers, the FTC said. The report did not indicate if the coronavirus pandemic and the ensuing lockdowns last year had anything to do with the increase in sales, but Bloomberg reported in April 2020 that Altria's first quarter sales had jumped partly as a result of bulk purchases, what the company calls pantry loading, suggesting that smokers stocked up on cigarettes fearing shortages. In 2020, total nicotine consumption in the U.S. was up 3.4%, said Don Burke, Senior Vice President of the Management Science Associates in Pittsburgh. So clearly the pandemic had an impact on the overall total nicotine delivery category. But the increase in sales last year looks unlikely to represent a long-term trend. Nielsen's convenience store report over a four-week period ending on March 27th of this year showed that overall sales of traditional cigarettes were down 4.9%, as reported by the Winston-Salem Journal. In recent years, sales of traditional cigarettes have steadily declined, while e-cigarettes have seen a surge, particularly among minors. A report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last year indicated that 1 in 5 high school students and more than 6% of U.S. adults now say they vape, which, by the way, as I've reported earlier, does not help you quit tobacco use. Okay, next up from Scientific American. Where gun stores open, gun homicides increase. When Illinois passed a law in 2014 permitting the concealed carry of firearms, becoming the last of the 50 states to do so, Sam Ranocchio opened Check Your Six, Inc. in the Chicago suburb of Arlington Heights. The store sells handguns and rifles and also offers concealed carry classes. The two kind of go hand in hand together, Ranocchio says. Check Your Six was one of hundreds of gun dealerships that opened across the United States between 2010 and 2017. Notes a preprint study that was published last month on social science research website SSRN and has not yet been peer-reviewed. According to the study, which looked at county-level data nationwide over a 17-year period, when the number of gun dealerships within 100 miles of a given area went up, the number of gun homicides in that area also increased in subsequent years, even as non-gun killings declined overall. Majority black communities bore the brunt of that violence, the study found. The sharp rise in gun violence seen in some black communities since 2014 had been widely attributed to the Ferguson effect. This term was coined by the then chief of the St. Louis police, who claimed violent crime increases were driven by officers' deteriorating morale following a nationwide protest of the 2014 police killing of unarmed black teenager Michael Brown in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri. But the study authors propose these increases are linked to a steep rise in gun dealerships specializing in handgun sales near majority black communities shortly before 2014. Before 2010, there had been a massive decline in gun dealers, says study co-author David Johnson, an economist at the University of Central Missouri. 3-4 years later, you start seeing declines in homicides, and then they pop right back up again once those gun dealers start re-entering the market. It's unclear what might have caused the number of dealerships to drop ahead of 2010, but the rebound in gun sales may have been driven by fears that then-President Barack Obama would enact strict gun control policies, according to a 2015 study published in the Journal of Public Economics. Gun availability is notoriously difficult to measure, partly because there is no federal registry of firearms. Previous studies have typically relied on gun suicide records, subscriptions to gun magazines, and survey data to estimate how many firearms are available in a given area. But the new study authors contend that these metrics are imprecise. Instead, they use data on federal firearm licenses, which gun dealerships are required to obtain from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, as a proxy measure of gun availability. The researchers compared this to FBI data, as well as to statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the U.S. Census Bureau to track homicides for every U.S. county. Their analysis found that when a gun dealership opens, homicides within a surrounding area of 100 square miles increased by as much as 3.9% in subsequent years. to help ensure they were not missing other factors that could have driven increases in both gun stores and homicides. The researchers also looked at killings that did not involve a firearm and found such non-gun homicides decreased during the study period. If the effect on homicides was not being driven primarily by the guns themselves, then we would expect non-gun homicides to be correlated with gun stores as well, which we show they are not. The increase in homicides is happening largely through the increase in gun availability. Daniel Webster, who directs the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Prevention and Policy and was not involved in the new study, says it raises a question of how to uniformly regulate gun shops. There's enormous variability from one gun dealer to another in terms of the rate at which they sell guns end up being used in crime, he says. I think that's not a function of chance. It's a function of how people run their businesses. He suspects that tighter regulations on gun shops, along with more oversight of dealerships, would reduce gun crimes. Illinois has some of the country's strictest gun laws, according to a gun control advocacy organization called Giffords Law Center, and there are no licensed gun dealers in Chicago. Yet, the city remains awash in firearms and is plagued by gun violence. Chicago is less than 100 miles from Wisconsin, Michigan, and Indiana. The latter borders the city itself. And all three have far fewer gun restrictions than Illinois. The SSRN study highlighted Chicago for this very reason, also noting that the city has a surrounding halo of Illinois counties where gun dealerships are concentrated. As a result, Chicagoans need not travel far to legally buy a firearm. Gun dealers introduce more guns into the community, says study co-author Joshua Robinson, an economist at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and that increased availability is not limited to law-abiding buyers. Firearms bought or stolen from other licensed dealerships in the suburbs and surrounding states frequently turn up in Chicago shootings. In one recent high-profile case, a gun allegedly purchased by an India resident in that state city of Hammond, which borders Chicago, was used in a fatal shooting of a Chicago police officer. In another, a man in Indianapolis allegedly bought a gun that was used to kill a 7-year-old girl in Chicago's West Side. That's why you keep hearing about straw purchases, says Wallace Gator Bradley, a former enforcer with the Gangster Disciples, a major Chicago street gang. Individuals that have a right to go buy a gun will go to the gun stores or go to the gun shows and buy the guns. They come right back. He adds that purchasers do not have to cross the state line to do so. You can go right to one of the suburbs and go buy a gun. We need to make sure that we're holding gun shops and gun manufacturers accountable, said Keena Collins, a gun violence prevention advocate who is primarying Congressman Danny Davis in Illinois' 7th District, which includes some of Chicago's hardest-hit neighborhoods, as well as parts of suburbs where gun dealerships are located. And we need to make sure we're in communication with other leaders in Midwestern states, because we're seeing a flow of legal guns continuously cross our state lines, Collins added. Grassroots, we need to make sure we're funding violence interruption programs because we know they work. Last Monday, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker called gun violence a public health crisis and announced the formation of a new statewide office for gun violence prevention. Pritzker vowed to earmark $250 million in state and federal funds to address the issue. Good Kids Mad City, a Chicago youth organization that advocates for non-carceral solutions to gun violence, argues that communities plagued by violence need less aggressive policing and more government investment to undo years of damage wrought by what it calls racist policies. The group has for years promoted a package of proposals collectively called the Peace Book Ordinance, which would divert 2% of Chicago's annual police budget of around $1.7 billion to fund services such as mental health and substance abuse treatment. Webster says holistic approaches are crucial to mitigating violence. There are some communities where disinvestment is substantial, and a lot of the systems, schools, transportation, housing, policing, are failing, he says. By policy and structure, people who are black are more concentrated in those neighborhoods, and that is intentional. It is a function of public policy over generations. Bradley says any solution requires entire cities to stand together against gun violence. No one person outside of God can stop it all, he says. And you know it like I know it. America is the biggest arms dealer in the world.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, let's switch gears and move to some food and nutrition news, this from the American Heart Association. New look at nutrition research identifies 10 features of a heart-healthy eating pattern. This is American Heart Association scientific statement. Highlights include, in a new statement on diet and heart health, the American Heart Association presents 10 key features of a heart-healthy eating pattern that can help reduce heart disease and stroke risk at all stages of life. The new statement emphasizes an overall dietary pattern to support cardiovascular health and general well-being that accommodates personal preferences, ethnic and religious practices, and life stages. For the first time, the association summarizes evidence that addresses sustainability, noting that heart-healthy eating patterns are also good for the environment. Also, for the first time, the statement enumerates several challenges, including societal factors that make it more difficult to adopt or maintain a heart-healthy eating pattern, and suggests public health measures to address these challenges, including early introduction of food and nutrition education at all school levels. The American Heart Association has outlined 10 key features of a heart-healthy eating pattern in a new scientific statement that emphasizes the importance of overall dietary pattern rather than individual foods or nutrients, and underscores the critical role of nutrition in all stages of life. These features can be adapted to accommodate individual food likes and dislikes, cultural traditions, and whether most meals are consumed at home or on the go, according to the statement, published in the association's flagship journal, Circulation. The new statement reflects the latest scientific evidence on the benefits of heart-healthy eating throughout the life, and that poor diet quality is strongly associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and death. The statement emphasizes the importance of looking to the total dietary pattern rather than good or bad individual foods or nutrients. A dietary pattern refers to the balance, variety, amounts, and combination of foods and beverages regularly eaten. The statement also highlights the critical role of nutrition education, starting healthy eating early in life and maintaining throughout the lifespan, as well as societal and other challenges that may make it harder to adopt or maintain heart-healthy diet patterns. We can all benefit from a heart-healthy dietary pattern, regardless of stage of life, and it is possible to design one that is consistent with personal preferences, lifestyle, and cultural customs. It does not need to be complicated, time-consuming, expensive, or unappealing, said the chair of the Scientific Statement Writing Group, Alice Lichtenstein, senior scientist and director of the Cardiovascular Nutrition Team at the USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging at Tufts University. Because food is often eaten in places besides the home, the statement emphasizes that it is possible to follow a heart-healthy dietary pattern, regardless of whether food is prepared at home, ordered in a restaurant, or online, or purchased as a prepared meal. You can absolutely adapt a heart-healthy diet to different lifestyles, said Lichtenstein, including one that incorporates eating out at restaurants. It might take a little planning. However, after the first few times, it can become routine. The statement details 10 features of a dietary pattern to promote heart health. 1. Balance food and calorie intake with physical activity to maintain a healthy weight. 2. Choose a wide variety and eat plenty of fruits and vegetables to get a full range of nutrients from food rather than supplements. 3. Choose whole grains and other foods made up mostly of whole grains. 4. Include healthy sources of lean and/or high-fiber proteins such as plant proteins, nuts and legumes, fish or seafood, low-fat or non-fat dairy, lean cuts of meat, and limit red and processed meats. 5. Use liquid, non-tropical plant oils, such as olive or sunflower oils. 6. Choose minimally processed foods rather than ultra-processed foods as much as possible. 7. Minimize intakes of beverages and foods with added sugars. 8. Choose or prepare foods with little or no salt. 9. Limit alcohol consumption. If you don't drink, do not start. And 10. Apply this guidance no matter where food is prepared or consumed. That's kind of a new one, but very wise. Processed foods include meats that are preserved by smoking, curing, or adding chemical preservatives, and plant-based foods that have added salt, sugar, or fats. Many processed meats are high in salt, saturated fats, and cholesterol. Research shows that replacing processed meats with other protein sources is associated with lower death rates. Ultra-processed foods are those that go beyond added salt, sweeteners, or fat to also include artificial colors, flavors, and preservatives that promote shelf stability, preserve texture, and increase palatability. Nutrition plays a critical role in heart health throughout life, according to the statement. A heart-healthy diet and healthy lifestyle behaviors, such as regular physical activity and avoiding exposure to tobacco products, are key from childhood through adulthood to lower the risk of developing elevated bad cholesterol levels, high blood pressure, obesity, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndrome, each of which can increase heart disease risk. Before and during pregnancy, women who eat a heart-healthy diet can reduce heart disease risk factors, which may help to prevent unhealthy weight gain in their children. Evidence shows that the prevention of childhood obesity is key to preserving and prolonging heart health throughout the lifespan. Later in life, people who eat a heart-healthy diet have slower age-related declines in thinking abilities and memory. The evidence indicates that people of all ages can benefit from sticking to the principles of a heart-healthy dietary pattern. Likewise, it is important to educate children at all ages so they can transition into adulthood. They will be able to make informed decisions about what they eat and serve as positive role models for generations to come. For the first time, the issue of sustainability is included in the association's dietary guidance. Commonly consumed animal products, particularly red meat, have the largest environmental impact in terms of water and land usage and contribute significantly to greenhouse gas emissions. Hence, shifting reliance from meat to plant proteins can help to improve individual health and the environment. It is important to recognize that the guidance is consistent not only with heart health, but also sustainability. It is a win-win for individuals and our environment. However, the statement notes not all sustainable diets are heart healthy. For example, if a plant-based diet includes lots of refined carbohydrates and added sugars, the risk of type 2 diabetes and heart disease increases. For the first time, the 2021 dietary guidance discusses several challenges that make it harder to adopt or maintain a heart-healthy diet. These include widespread dietary misinformation from the internet, a lack of nutrition education in grade schools and medical schools, food and nutrition insecurity. According to references cited in the statement, an estimated 37 million Americans had limited or unstable access to safe and nutrition foods in 2020. Structural racism and neighborhood segregation, whereby many communities have a higher proportion of racial and ethnic diversity, have few grocery stores but many fast food outlets. And targeted marketing of unhealthy foods and beverages to people from diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds through tailored advertising efforts and sponsorship of events and organizations in those communities. Public health action and policy changes are required to address these challenges and barriers. Creating an environment that promotes and supports adherence to heart-healthy dietary patterns among all individuals is a public health imperative, the statement concludes. On an individual level, the new statement reinforces a 2020 American Heart Association statement for healthcare professionals that encouraged routine assessment of patients' dietary quality and inclusion of this information in the medical record, so there's follow-up the next appointment. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up, another story from the American Heart Association, which can relate to many people's personal health here in the U.S. Most U.S. adults unaware that over-the-counter pain relievers may increase blood pressure. A new survey commissioned by the American Heart Association found high blood pressure patients unsure of how to safely treat pain. While a majority of adults in the general population, as well as people with high blood pressure, aren't sure about the effect of over-the-counter pain medication on their blood pressure, only a little more than half of those diagnosed with high blood pressure who take over-the-counter pain relievers check with their doctor before taking this medicine. Because some pain relievers may cause elevated blood pressure, the American Heart Association recommends consulting your doctor or pharmacist and making sure you read the label before taking any over-the-counter medication for pain, especially if you've been diagnosed with high blood pressure. Conducted by the Harris Poll, the survey polled over 2,000 U.S. adults age 18 and older. Additional findings from the survey include 38% of those with high blood pressure think over-the-counter pain relievers may raise blood pressure. Only 21% of U.S. adults know that acetaminophen does not raise blood pressure, and those with high blood pressure are only slightly more aware of this fact at 28%. 39% of U.S. adults with high blood pressure report acetaminophen is over-the-counter medication they take most often for pain. Only 10% of U.S. adults with high blood pressure self-measure their blood pressure multiple times a day, and only 14% do so at least once a day. So less than a quarter check their blood pressure at least daily. In the U.S., high blood pressure is the number one preventable cause of heart disease and stroke, and second only to cigarette smoking as a preventable cause of death for any reason. Checking your blood pressure regularly at home with a validated blood pressure device for the most accurate reading and working with your doctor on a plan to control it is a proven way to manage your blood pressure. And another heart health story, also from the Heart Association. Less than 10% of adults with heart failure get cardiac rehab despite Medicare expansion. In 2014, Medicare expanded coverage for cardiac rehabilitation to include adults with heart failure, given studies showing cardiac rehab can improve physical function and reduce death and hospitalizations. In the 3 years after this Medicare coverage began, 2014 to 2017, enrollment in cardiac rehab among Medicare beneficiaries with heart failure increased from 4.3% to 5.5%, a relative annual increase of about 10%. That was nearly double the increase 6 years prior to the expansion, when enrollment rose from 3.3% to 4.3%, a relative annual increase of about 5%. Although the addition of Medicare coverage increased enrollment, researchers said less than 10% of eligible adults with heart failure take part in cardiac rehab, and other interventions should be taken to increase enrollment in cardiac rehab. There are nearly 1.1 million hospitalizations for heart failure annually, making it one of the most common reasons for hospital admissions for people 65 years of age and older, whose healthcare costs are primarily covered by Medicare, said study author Vinay Gudaguntla, a third-year internal resident medicine resident at the University of California, San Francisco. Despite recent advancements in treatment, long-term survival after hospitalization is poor for adults with heart failure. Overall, more than 70% of adults with heart failure are rehospitalized or die within 1 year after discharge. In addition, most experience declining exercise capacity and reductions in daily living activities and quality of life. There is strong evidence that a supervised exercise regimen, like the physical activity plan integrated into cardiac rehab programs, can prevent death, reduce hospitalization, and improve physical function in adults with heart failure. Just another example of just because we know something is good for you in healthcare doesn't mean it's actually provided, even if it's paid for, in this example, through Medicare. Okay, well, I want to end big and perhaps, I suppose, on some good news. This from Discover Magazine. Are some countries happier than others? The December sun never rises above the horizon on Finland's Arctic North. Even in the far south of the country where the bulk of Finns live, residents witness merely 6 hours of sunlight per day in the depths of winter. Despite this darkness, Finland is officially the world's happiest country and has earned this accolade for 4 years in a row. That's according to the United Nations 2021 World Happiness Report, which is based on a single, albeit subjective, question. Participants all around the globe are asked to rate their happiness on a scale of 1 to 10. Other Nordic nations, including Iceland, Denmark, and Sweden, also hold top spots on the list. The only non-European country that scores among the happiest 10 is New Zealand. Meanwhile, nations including Afghanistan, South Sudan, and Zambia consistently fall towards the bottom of the list. The United States currently sits at number 14. Other rankings show similar outcomes. The Laggedum Prosperity Index, which measures economic and social well-being, also reports relatively high levels of bliss within Nordic nations compared to those experiencing intense conflict. And while lack of wealth might lead a nation at the bottom of the table, money alone isn't enough to push a country to the top. Take Hong Kong, for example. It's the 10th richest country in the world when it comes to gross national income, according to the World Bank data, but Hong Kong is positioned in the bottom half of the UN's index, behind nations with lower gross national income such as Albania, Ghana, and Ecuador. However, researchers say stable politics, social safety nets, free health care, and high levels of public trust in a democratic system are the ingredients for a happy population. In the end, it's not the culture, it's the institutions of a country, says Frank Martella, psychology researcher at Aalto University in Finland, who contributes to the UN report. Hong Kong's less than stellar performance is part of a regional trend, which concludes that progress slowed in Asia-Pacific mainly due to deterioration in safety and security, personal freedom, economic quality, and education. India marks another example in which increasing wealth doesn't necessarily translate to rising happiness. For the last 10 years, its GDP has been growing rapidly, but its happiness is going down. This could be a manifestation of political instability in the subcontinent and growing tensions between India's religious communities. So how exactly has Northern Europe managed to achieve such a satisfied state of mind? When we went through all the research on this question, it seems like institutions are best able to predict happiness on a national level. Nordic countries have quite a few things going for them, such as extensive welfare, free kindergarten, and healthcare. These things are key because they mean that people can trust society to take care of them if something goes wrong in their life. According to data gathered by Reporters Without Borders, Nordic people also enjoy the world's least press censorship and corruption. The quality of democratic institutions is therefore high. If citizens have confidence that the democratic system is working, then they're more likely to feel like their vote matters. That's another boost to residents' wellness. What all of this means? Government officials should rethink how they evaluate the impact of their policies. Gross domestic products has been used as a shorthand for success for too long. The ultimate aim of government should be to ensure as many citizens as possible are happy. And of course, that includes many of the social determinants of health. Okay, well, I'm going to close quickly here with the 7 bonus articles. I'll give you the link at the end, which you can look at online, as well as the stories I've covered here. 1, what COVID vaccines for young kids could mean for the pandemic. 2, molnupiravir, another COVID-19 treatment, another opportunity to recognize inequity. It's one thing to have a drug, it's another thing to get it to people with equitably. 3, what Moderna owes the world. Moderna is the one that received a lot of public support and doesn't seem to be coming true to its promises. 4, here's who wins and loses in Democrats' new prescription drug pricing deal. 5, is the debate over the origin of COVID-19 still worth having? 6, babies are dying of syphilis. It's 100% preventable. And 7, you might be interested in checking this one out yourself, the most detailed map of cancer-causing industrial air pollution in the U.S. Check it out for yourself and your family and friends around the country. You can read these stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.